From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, sitting in for Terry Gross. Last week's execution in Nigeria of human rights activist Ken Saro-Wiwa and other activists has been met with international condemnation. Saro-Wiwa was leader of a movement protesting the environmental impact of multinational oil companies operating in Nigeria. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Richard Dicker, Associate Counsel for Human Rights Watch, and with Brian Anderson, Managing Director of Shell Petroleum Development Corporation of Nigeria. Also, Pop Action. We talk with choreographer Elizabeth Streb about her work, which combines dance and athletics, using such props as scaffolding, trampolines, and walls. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Clinton is set to make a statement at this hour regarding the budget standoff, and there are indications the administration may call some of the 800,000 furloughed federal employees back to work. This could be accomplished by designating them essential workers. White House Press Secretary Mike McCurry says employees who weren't considered essential at the start of the shutdown could become essential if the loss of various government services becomes troublesome to the public. The gates are going up at all of the national parks, battlefields, and monuments in the U.S. in response to the government's partial shutdown. Many parks were still open to campers and sightseers, even though visitor centers and trails had closed. NPR's Howard Berkus has more.
People in national park campgrounds and hotels across the country, from Arcadia in Maine to the Everglades in Florida to Yosemite in California, have been told to pack up and leave. Though most parks were officially closed Monday when the government at least partially shut down, many have still been accessible. Ranger talks were suspended, visitor centers closed, and trails were closed, but tourists could still drive into campgrounds, hotels, and scenic overlooks. Now gates will block park entrance roads. All visitors will be turned away. A National Park Service spokesman says the partial shutdown of the government has left the agency shorthanded. We can't guarantee the health and safety of visitors, he said. More than 700,000 people visit the national parks, monuments, battlefields, and historic sites on an average day. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
Attorney General Janet Reno says she has Parkinson's disease. So far, Reno says her only symptom is a trembling in her left hand. Reno says she's taking medicine to control the ailment and she intends to stay on the job. She's 57 years old. Reno is one of an estimated 500,000 to 1 million Americans with Parkinson's. The nation's Catholic bishops have ended their four-day conference in Washington. The meeting was sparked by a series of strong statements on behalf of the poor. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
The bishops' conference took place against the backdrop of the larger drama going on in Washington, the standoff between President Clinton and Congress over the budget. And while the bishops insisted their statements were nonpartisan and based solely on Catholic teaching on social justice, it is clear the bishops are strongly opposed to a number of Republican budget proposals. The bishops sent a letter to Capitol Hill and approved a separate statement that criticized some welfare reform measures, the earned income tax credit, and what it called punitive treatment of immigrants. The bishops also approved a statement on economic justice that said the U.S. is falling short on the ultimate measure of a moral society, how it treats the poor and the weak. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington.
On Wall Street, the stock market is surging toward the 5,000 mark. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 36.5 points now at 4959.24 in heavy trading of 341 million shares. This is NPR News. A federal jury has found the former head of the White House Travel Office not guilty of charges he embezzled $68,000. Billy Dale broke down in tears as the jury foreman read the verdict. For over 30 years, Dale worked in the office that plans travel for members of the news media covering the president. He was fired at the beginning of the Clinton administration. Dale's lawyer claims his client was a scapegoat for an inept attempt by Clinton insiders to take control of the potentially lucrative travel office business. Millions of Algerians are voting today in their first multi-candidate presidential election ever, NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Thousands of heavily armed government security forces stood guard outside polling stations throughout the country amid threats of political violence by Muslim extremists trying to disrupt the vote. President Lamine Zerawal appears to be the favorite in a four-man race. He is being challenged by moderate Islamist Mahfouz Nahna, Nureddin Boukrou, and anti-Islamist Saeed Saadi. If none of the candidates captures at least 50% of the vote, a presidential runoff will be held December 15th. The election is being held despite a boycott by the Islamic Salvation Front. Nearly 4 years ago, Algeria's military-backed regime imprisoned front leaders, banned the party, and canceled multi-party elections that were expected to vault the front to power. Since 1992, an estimated 40,000 people have been killed in a civil war between government security forces and Muslim rebel factions. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
The 17-year-old boy who's accused in the shooting spree at a Tennessee high school this week that left two people dead and one wounded may be charged as an adult, but prosecutors say they will not seek the death penalty because of the boy's age. The world's largest tire maker, Michelin, has confirmed that it will invest $500 million to expand its manufacturing operations in South Carolina. The tire maker says up to 1,600 new jobs may be created in South Carolina over the next 5 years. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. Last Friday, the Nigerian military government executed writer and civil rights activist Ken Saro-Wiwa and 8 other political activists in spite of protests from countries and human rights groups that their lives be spared. They had been found guilty of inciting murder in a trial that had been criticized for flagrant civil rights violations. General Sani Abacha, head of the country's military regime, is now facing international condemnation. Nelson Mandela is leading a campaign to impose a worldwide oil embargo on Nigeria. There have also been calls to freeze the personal assets of General Abacha. Most of the oil deposits are in the southeast region of the country, home to different ethnic groups, including the Ogonis. Shell Oil has been working in Nigeria for 60 years and was the object of local protests 2 years ago in Ogoni land. Ken Saro-Wiwa led those protests against Shell as one of the founders of an environmental group, the Movement of the Survival of the Ogoni People, or MOSOP. We invited Richard Dicker to join us today on Fresh Air to discuss the recent events in Nigeria. Dicker is Associate Counsel for Human Rights Watch. Nigeria is the largest and most populous country in Africa. I asked Dicker what position it holds among other African nations.
Nigeria had, on account of both its population, its size, and its tremendous natural resources, provided a source of inspiration and hope in terms of the potential of African economic development for a number of years. Given the misrule that the country has been subjected to for the last 5 or more years in particular, and the developments since June 1993, I think Nigeria has come more to represent in the eyes of the international community and in Africa more and more broadly, a very sad example of misrule by military officials bent on human rights abuse, really diminishing the tremendous natural potential of the country.
Well, one of the leaders of the movement to criticize and to demonstrate against Shell Oil was Ken Saro-Wiwa, the writer and poet who was executed last Friday, and Ogoni himself. He's the founder, who was the founder, of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People. What was this movement about? What did they want?
Well, essentially, the MOSOP, the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, was founded in the early 1990s in response to the environmental degradation of their land and waters, and demanding essentially two things. One, a cessation to the environmentally damaging processes that Shell employed, and also a more equitable system of compensation for those people whose lands were despoiled by the oil company's operations and received very little in return by way of financial resources from Nigeria's central government or from the Rivers State Administration. The region was noticeably lacking in infrastructure or other basic services, even though it was the source of so much of the country's natural wealth and governmental revenue.
What was the impact of the environmental impact of Shell oil in the Ogoni region?
Well, there was a great deal of devastation of cropland, farmland, poisoning of waterways and fish. There were injuries suffered when there were various accidents and gas flare-ups that frequently happened, both damage to land, water, and human life that the Ogoni people experienced as a result of the proximity to environmentally very, very negative oil drilling and refining processes.
This group, the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People that Ken Sarawiwa headed up, what kinds of activities, what kinds of demonstrations did they do against Shell oil in Ogoni land?
Well, they engaged in a number of peaceful protest rallies and demonstrations, and that's really where the cycle of violence that culminated in last week's executions began. Protests took place in Ogoni land in proximity to Shell facilities, and Shell decided to summon the support and protection of the River State Internal Security Task Force to protect its facilities in the face of, at the time, basically peaceful protests. This bringing in of the River State Internal Security Task Force led to a campaign of state violence against the Ogoni people that was shocking in both its scope and brutality.
Well, give us a description then of what that response was.
Well, there were numerous incidents in which security and military forces attacked Ogoni villages under a pretext, as was told to the troops, that they were repelling invaders from Cameroon, a neighboring African country, or in fact they were helping to keep peace between the Ogoni and the Andoni, another neighboring minority ethnic group. Troops were dispatched into the area and effectively committed, they pillaged villages inhabited by the Ogonis. I think the figures that we have were as high as 1,000 people, 1,000 Ogonis being killed in 1993 as a result of government security force raids on their villages. There were numerous rapes carried out in the process of this response by the Nigerian military, essentially to Shell's appeal for protection of its facilities in the area.
You describe the movement's activities as peaceful. Shell Oil has said that they lost $40 million to sabotage. Do you have any evidence that that is true?
Well, I think I cannot I can't say anything about the claim in terms of dollar amount. Suffice it to say that in the face of the kind of outrages committed by the security forces, there were acts of violence committed by Ogonis, directed both to physical facility, Shell property, and also human life.
What was Shell Oil supposed to do when MOSOP was demonstrating and protesting and even trespassing on their land? Who were they supposed to call, if not the government?
Well, I think they could have sat down and had reasonable discussions with MOSOP in response to their issues. If, in fact, they felt compelled to call for government security protection, when that military force came on the scene and then engaged in a pogrom against the Ogoni people, Shell had a responsibility at that juncture to speak out publicly and criticize the excessive use of force by the security forces at the time. Shell was silent.
When did Shell Oil leave?
They decided to withdraw from Ogoni land in mid-1993, and I think, in fact, that's when the greater proportion of damage to their facilities took place after they had withdrawn from their operations there.
My guest is Richard Dicker, Associate Counsel for Human Rights Watch. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Richard Dicker is my guest, Associate Counsel for Human Rights Watch. We're talking about Nigeria. There was a multi-party election in 1993, and this was actually going on while some of the demonstrations were going on in Ogoni land, the demonstrations led by Ken Sarawiwa. What kind of government does Nigeria have today as a result of those elections?
Nigeria has a military government that represents a small clique of military officers who came to power in November 1993 after the multi-party elections of June had been suppressed and a civilian government installed by a previous military president had been ousted by the General Abacha coup. It is, by any stretch of definition, a government that exists in opposition to the demonstrated opinion of Nigerian people.
The reports about the government led by General Sani Abacha is that it's a government of corruption, repression, economic mismanagement, drug trafficking, and a government that really is creating an even greater divide between the very wealthy and most of the Nigerian people who are rather poor. Is that a fair assessment of his government?
Well, our expertise extends to human rights practices. And commenting on that, it is clear that the human rights situation in the country has deteriorated dramatically in the 2 years that General Abacha has been in office. There are credible reports, of course, in terms of drug trafficking, corruption, Swiss bank accounts that certainly fit the picture of a military government that has ruthlessly suppressed its own people for its own interests. Yeah.
Getting back then to the story, and again, there's several chapters. Getting back to Ogoni land, in May of 1994, four Ogonis with ties to the Abacha government were murdered. Were actually burned alive. Sarawiwa was charged with their murder and then condemned to die. Where was he during these murders?
He was not anywhere in the location of where the murders took place. And in the course of a large rally or demonstration, and there was never any allegation that he was present at the scene. The murders of those four individuals, however unfortunate those actions were, and indeed they were unfortunate, became the pretext for the Nigerian military regime to arrest Ken Sarawiwa and a number of other activists within MOSOP and begin the process that led to their execution.
Sarwiwa was arrested along with eight other Ogonis.
Correct.
What kind of trial was it?
Well, they were tried by a special military tribunal, which had been authorized by several regulations implemented by the military governments. There was no semblance of respect for due process or international and Nigerian protections for defendants on trial for capital crimes. It became impossible for Sarawiva's lawyers to introduce into court evidence that cast doubt on the credibility of a principal prosecution witness. The lawyers were prevented from meeting with their clients, and ultimately, in protest against the unfairness of the process at this special military tribunal, the lawyers withdrew from the case.
Sarawiwa was hanged along with eight other Ogonis last Friday. What do you think the effect has been on the country? What do you think the government's message was to the people of Nigeria?
Well, the message was, you step out of line and we will execute you. They wanted to send that signal very, very, very clearly. There are reports that have appeared in the press that the initiative for carrying out the sentence in the face of worldwide condemnation was the need on General Abacha's part to project a tough image so as not to encourage any coup plots against him. So there was a plan to send the message that you step out of line, you raise these kinds of issues and questions about multinational oil companies and their role in the country and their relationship with the military government, and this is the fate you can expect.
Are there other protest groups, civil rights groups that are active at all?
Nigeria has had over the years a very dynamic and vibrant civil society composed of lawyers groups, workers organizations, trade unions, and opposition press. And over the last few years, virtually every sector of that civil society has been intimidated, arrested, facing one or another kind of punitive measure by the government. So Nigerian civil society, which has played a vitally important role, has been weakened by the human rights violations of the Abacha regime.
Nigeria has been condemned for these executions by the Commonwealth, by a number of countries, Nelson Mandela. Several countries have withdrawn their embassies. The World Bank has canceled a $100 million loan. Does the outside world have any kind of pressure input into Nigeria?
I think it does. The condemnation has been impressive. It's you mentioned the Commonwealth countries, European Union, the International Finance Corporation of the World Bank, various governments recalling their ambassadors, etc. Those are important steps. They make a difference. Nigeria's lifeline economically is its oil export. There is serious effort underway to analyze the potential and viability for an oil embargo of Nigeria. I don't think there are adequate results from that yet, but Nigeria is subject to outside international pressure, and it needs to be ratcheted up in a way that isolates the Abacha military regime.
How invincible would you say Sonny Abacha is, General Sonny Abacha? And if outsiders, either companies or governments, were to freeze assets, would that have any effect on those in power?
Well, the assets that we have proposed freezing are, first and foremost, their personal assets around the world. Money that they have squirreled away in Swiss bank accounts, homes that they own in Europe and elsewhere. that would certainly send a very stinging message to these generals and their cronies that there is some accountability for their actions.
What do you want Shell Oil to do in 1995 in response to what happened?
Several things. First, publicly and privately condemn the executions that occurred. Shell has yet to make any definitive statement about the nature of the executions that took place. Its statement last week effectively warned against any outside public protest, saying that Shell preferred quiet diplomacy. Well, in this instance, quiet diplomacy has proven to be a stunning failure, and I think more accurately, a self-serving rationalization for doing nothing. Shell has a role to play publicly denouncing what happened, privately using its influence, and in particular, yesterday, there was an important meeting in Nigeria of the joint venture partners for a huge natural gas liquefaction program, or rather plant, that will go online in several years that will cost roughly $4 billion. Shell owns 24% equity in that project. That project financially is very important to the Abacha regime, and we had issued a public letter to Shell, to Elf, and to AGIP, French and Italian oil companies involved in this same project, to express their unwillingness to go forward unless certain substantial, tangible human rights improvements took place.
I guess the question is, and I'm sure the challenge for many of the companies is what responsibility do we have for a government? We're a business. We're a company. And a government is something different.
Indeed. And we are not so naive to mistake that important difference. But our point is that these are businesses that have an important stake in the country, that have influential connections and contact with officials in the government in producing a product that is critical to the government's continued financial stability, and can privately and publicly make their views known, not on domestic political issues, but on issues of human rights, universally protected human rights importance. So in the instance of Shell, there was some more direct complicity working with the military regime, we believe, in suppressing what was initially peaceful protest by the Ogoni people. I think Shell has a great deal to answer for and cannot simply say we're a private entity, we're not a government. Shell has responsibility for bringing the military into the picture back in 1993 that, again, led to the whole chain of events that we're here discussing.
Richard Dicker is Associate Counsel for Human Rights Watch. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our discussion about the execution of human rights activists in Nigeria and the presence of multinational oil companies in the country with Brian Anderson of Shell Petroleum Development Corporation of Nigeria. And we talk with Elizabeth Streb about her work, which combines dance, athletics, daring, and precision. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. Last Friday, Nigerian playwright and activist Ken Saro-Wiwa and eight other Nigerian activists were executed after being found guilty for inciting murder. South African President Nelson Mandela called their hangings a heinous act. British Prime Minister John Major called their deaths judicial murder. The charges against Saro-Wiwa and the eight other activists go back 2 years to demonstrations against Shell Oil, which has been stationed in oil-rich Nigeria for over 60 years. We called Brian Anderson in London for a response. He's the managing director of the Shell Petroleum Development Corporation of Nigeria. Much of the protest was about Shell's environmental record in Nigeria. I asked Anderson what he saw as Shell's responsibility for the environment.
Well, in many senses, it's one of our key responsibilities. You can imagine that we're operating in a very widespread area in the Niger Delta, which is a sensitive ecosystem. So we have a responsibility to try to avoid as much as possible the impact of our operations affecting the Delta and of course, the people that live in the Delta. But I must say, and as I will never deny the fact that we have had problems with pollution from oil spills occasionally, and also we continue to flare gas that is produced together with the oil because of lack of local market for the gas and the inability to re-inject it back in the ground due to the local geological problems there.
Back in 1993, A group was started, the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, or MOSOP. They began to protest against Shell Oil and its facilities in this Niger region. What was the response of Shell Oil?
Well, our company, of course, works in many places, including the area which you refer to, the Ogoni area. The Ogoni area is a small part of the delta in the eastern area with population density that is very high compared to the rest of the delta. We have had considerable call, if you like, from the Ogoni people to pay reparations. They've called on the government for some form of autonomy and for payment of back royalties and so on. They've created, on the back of an environmental issue, they've created a very strong political issue, and hence created for us, of course, a considerable problem when it comes to separating the two.
Did Shell ever sit down with any of the leaders of MOSOP?
No, we do talk to the leaders of MOSOP, and we have done in the past, and even now when we have the opportunity, we will do so. But you must appreciate, perhaps, that in MOSOP, there have been two factions. One faction, led by Ken Saro-Wiwa, broke away from the main MOSOP group. He formed a youth wing, which became very physically active, if I can put that way, in the Delta, in the Ogoni area. And he was using those people to achieve certain ends. The moderate part of the Ogoni MOSOP leadership are people with whom we have discussed many times, and also with Ken Saro-Wiwa. So we've tried to maintain a dialogue throughout the problems.
Why in 1993 did Shell call in then the Nigerian government forces to put down the demonstrators? What was going on that forced Shell to do that?
We have had problems sometimes with the communities attacking our people and our facilities. And just like anywhere else in the world, if you have a sudden incursion into your own facilities with risk of personal harm to the people, you need to ask for the police to intervene to protect the situation. That's what happened. And unfortunately, as a result of that, and I think you're referring to the Imwechem incident, the police became involved in a battle in which one policeman was killed. Following that, there was further response from the police, which resulted in a lot more injuries and some deaths. We had no intention, of course, of having this outcome. And since that incident, and since incidents of that kind, we have been extremely careful to advise the police not to use any kind of violent approach, even though sometimes they are being attacked and quite badly by the communities if they try to stop them vandalizing our equipment or hurting our people.
Ken Saraviva was arrested along with eight other Ogonis after a killing in 1994. He was put on trial, and that trial has been very publicly condemned by many human rights organizations and by governments around the world as a real miscarriage of justice. Did Shell Oil and Shell Nigeria have a position on that trial? Did you make any public statements about that trial?
No, and I don't think we should.
Why not?
Because our company is not a company that should make an involvement, take an involvement in a judicial finding. We have said all along that it's up to the courts and up to the people of Nigeria to determine the processes that they go through. We did later on ask for clemency because on humanitarian grounds and on grounds that we felt it was more likely that the solution to the Ogoni issue would be successful if there was clemency granted. We asked for clemency, but we didn't take a position on the trial, and we would not do so.
Ken Saraviva and the eight Ogonis were executed last Friday. Again, much worldwide condemnation. Has Shell Nigeria or Shell Oil made a public statement about those executions?
Yes, we have, and I think you may have had those public statements in written form. We regret very much what happened there, and I've just told you our effort to try to avoid this outcome.
Nigeria is an oil-rich country, and Shell Oil is a established international corporation. Do you think Shell has any kind of leverage with the military government in Nigeria, surely because of the importance and value of oil to that country?
We have, of course, a potential influence, but we are very cautious indeed about trying to use such influence. It is generally inappropriate to do so, particularly, and I must reemphasize that, we do not believe it's in the companies like Shell's interests and should not be carried out, that we become involved in the political issues of a country. Our job and our intent is to work together with the people of the country for their commercial success and for the wealth generation for the people of the country. We have to stay with that, and that's our mandate, and that's why we are able and have been invited, if you like, with our licenses and so on, to operate. Nobody would prefer us to work on the political side, as you can imagine.
How can you not be involved? I guess, again, because of the sheer size of Shell Nigeria, and also the fact that Nigeria is such an oil-rich country. Is it possible, really, to stay out of the political, social, and even economic life of a country like Nigeria?
No, I was referring to the political life. We become involved, of course, in the economic life, and that's just what I mentioned. I think you have to understand that it is not our remit to try to influence the government on the political agenda. We will try to influence them on issues to do with the commercial interests of our company and what we believe could be the correct policies for the government to follow for the economic benefit of the country. And we do so, and we try to assist the process of selection and implementation of policies that help to develop the country. Now, of course, sometimes it gets very close to the political side, but we try and I think successfully achieve to maintain impartiality and a lack of intervention when it becomes a political issue. And that's true in every country where we work, and I think most people would understand that.
The Abacha government has been accused of funneling oil profits off for their personal profits. And again, I wonder whether you or Shell Nigeria has a position on that.
No, I have no position on it, and I have no direct knowledge of anything like that.
All righty. Well, Brian Anderson, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
I appreciate you squeezing us in. Brian Anderson is Managing Director of the Shell Petroleum Development Corporation of Nigeria. This is Fresh Air. Choreographer Elizabeth Streb calls her performance pieces pop action. They're part dance, part gymnastics, part circuits performance, and part pure daredevil. Her troupe called Streb Ringside engage in heart-stopping, gravity-defying feats as they hurl themselves through space, move in elaborate patterns and harnesses attached to scaffolding, bounce off of trampolines, and crash into surfaces, creating a high-energy kaleidoscope of sound and shape. Streb believes that her work should be very accessible. She makes rehearsals open to the public and performs in very public spaces like shopping malls and off the side of the Brooklyn Bridge. Elizabeth Streb founded her company in the mid-80s after realizing that her approach to dance and movement didn't fit the dance scene of the day. I asked her what was missing.
What was missing was the thrust of the action, the velocity, the impact, the experience of movement, in short. I didn't feel that I even felt anything happening to my body when I would train.
It wasn't demanding enough? You didn't feel the movements enough?
Well, it was demanding in a different sort of way. Like, it was painful because the balletic form really stretched and pulled your bones and your muscles all around. So it's not that it wasn't physically demanding, but it was not demanding in a way that I had been acquainted with action in the past. And I was obsessed with action from the time I was very, very young. But the kind of action that goes very fast downhill on skis.
Okay, I was going to say, what kind of action are we talking about, Elizabeth?
Or watching accidental movements of people everywhere, or going to a rodeo or a bullfight, which I did once, or watching boxing, or even in the circus. That's what I thought action was. And I thought dance was going to be the art of movement.
You call your work pop action. It's not dance. It's not performance art. How would you describe to the uninitiated what pop action is?
Okay. Well, it comes from really a formal investigation that's gone on over about a 20-year period. And pop action is really what you see when you sit in a seat and watch what we do. It describes bodies that literally are flying through the air and doing that by popping their muscles and not utilizing the normal transitions that dance traditionally engages in, like the transfer of weight skeletally from one foot to another. If we want to get off the stage, we just fly off the stage. And if that doesn't work, then we just disappear.
You're interested then in pushing the body. We'll get to the mind, but in pushing the body beyond what seems like a normal limit, even for a dancer?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, I want the dancer themselves has to have this thirst that is really beyond beyond a normal thirst for the investigation of the outer regions of what they're capable of physically. And the general premise is nothing is physically impossible, absolutely nothing. So I want them, when I ask them to do different things, to just go, yeah, that's possible, yeah, that's possible. One time I asked a dancer, do you think that when you do a flip, another dancer could dive through the center of the space that flip doesn't occupy, you know, which requires really perfect aim and millisecond timing. And they just go, well, yes, I think I can do it, but we have to figure it out.
And did they?
Yeah. Yeah, they did. But it took us about a month to figure that one out.
Do your dancers get hurt a lot?
I don't think that they get hurt a lot. I think that the stakes are a lot higher when they miss a move. So, for instance, if somebody crashes, it's pretty serious. Because of the fact of the high impact and the hard surfaces.
What then is a practice routine like? If you're working on a particular piece and literally starting from scratch, and maybe Up is a good one to talk about. This is one of your newer pieces. It's a trampoline parallel bar. You have six dancers. Take us, I guess, through the steps of preparation.
Okay, that's a good one because, I mean, in fact, for some unknown reason, this dance has created more injuries than any other dance I've ever done in the last 20 years. And part of it is it starts with a trampoline, which I like to call a surface exploder. And I actually did a lot of research, and it's a hotbed, and I bought it in Australia, and they shipped it here. And there aren't a lot like it. In fact, when a tramp expert came in our studio to give us some drills, he said he wouldn't work on that tramp bed.
Really?
It's sprung so tight that there's no hot spot in the center. The whole thing is a hot spot. So we started bouncing on it. And to me, the idea was very simple. It was, I was trying to emphasize the direction up, because that, I thought, in the general course of the dance history, that's a direction that had been left out pretty seriously. So I thought that this would be a piece of equipment that would allow me to get into that space, which is a lot of how I decide what I'm going to do next. Then we banked on both sides of this tramp two scaffold towers. And then to connect the scaffold towers 10 feet above the bed, we put two parallel pipes. So what happens is the dancers jump off and on, and there's six of them, this tramp bed, and they either go back to the landing that they jumped off of, the scaffold tower, or they go up to the pipes, or they dive off in kind of a bevel dive and land on their stomach off the tramp on these pole vaulting pits that we have on both the upstage and downstage side of the tramp. So there's a lot of different ways they can both enter and exit. But the most complicated and dangerous part of this dance is that you can only have one person at a time hitting that tramp bed, and there's six people. So a lot of the actions have four or five people involved. While one's in the air, the other's on the bed, or one's a little bit further in the air or up to the pipes. And the problem is, if their timing gets off, I mean at all, one person jumps on the bed at the same time as another person, that one person gets their jump shot. That's an expression in trampolining. And that means that they exponentially get thrust off that tramp bed in a direction that's not predictable. And it's not over till it's over, and it's usually not very pretty.
Looking at your work, I'm reminded of the one and only time I ever rappelled off a cliff.
You only did it once?
I only did it once.
Once is enough.
And I stood terrified at the top of the cliff, just right at the very edge of the cliff, and just terrified of taking that one step backwards.
Oh, yeah.
The whole world was going to flip on its side. Nice. And yet when I finally did that, I had this sense of excitement and exhilaration that I've rarely ever felt. Is that what you're looking for with your dancers?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, that's a perfect explanation. It's like going backwards and slightly upside down is all the bells go off in your mind. No, don't do that. You know, you really have to fight what we call breakthrough the kind of anti-intuitive zone to really make yourself do that. But that kind of exhilaration and that kind of cathartic event we experience every day. And I really believe it's like discovering the fountain of youth. You know, if you're willing to do that, you really will never die on some level.
How do you encourage your dancers who feel scared at that moment?
It's a good question. I mean, a lot of people ask us, how do we deal with fear, or are we simply not scared? And it's not true that we're not scared. Even I, who've been doing it the longest, am pretty terrified right before a performance or right before I have to actually go do a move. And I think that when I get different dancers, though, are terrified of different moments. Like some dancer just doesn't want to go upside down on the trampoline and land on their feet because they're afraid they're going to hit the bed of the tramp on their heads. And they I can tell they're scared because, you know, I can see it in their eyes. And what we do then is just break down the moves and take it step by step by step. It actually isn't okay if no one ever really says, I won't do this. They do. I try and encourage them to say, I'm scared. And when they say I'm scared, then we all kind of work, especially the ones that have been scared too, but accomplished the move. We work at breaking it down. And then in the end, I have to say to them, you know, you just have to do it. Just do it. You're going to find out that it's not so bad.
But once you've dissected the move, then, and they've mastered all the various parts of it, it's easier to put it all together.
A little easier, but to tell you the truth, physically, I don't think it helps at all. I think it's more about them feeling like they're prepared. It's almost a ritual that they need to go through to then do it. But to me, I never think breaking down a move gives you any extra physical information about that move, because it's not at all like the animal it has to be to actually just do it in time and space the way it needs to be accomplished.
Well, we're going to take a very short break, and then we're going to talk some more. And Elizabeth Streb is our guest. She's a choreographer and founder of Streb Ringside. And I guess for lack of a better word, it's a dance troupe. And she's talking to us about her work. We'll be back after a very short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Elizabeth Streb, and she's a choreographer and founder of Streb Ringside. Were you interested in dance as a young girl? Was this something that goes way, way back?
I kind of hate dance. You know, I hated dance back then, and I kind of don't like it now in terms of how it exists as a tradition. I wasn't enamored at all like some young girls were. I was more an athlete, and I was interested in being a professional basketball player. I was really going to college to be a PE teacher because that was the only thing available in the 60s. But then I saw dance, and I was a visual artist. I could draw very well, and I was very involved in art. And I thought that dance would be a great combination of those two things. I found out that the tradition of dance is really, movement is not really the subject in the tradition of dance.
What then is it about?
Right. To me, and this is my opinion purely, but to me, dance exists in three separate zones. One is it believes traditionally that it is able to express emotion, so it's expressionistic. I don't believe that it does that, that movement does that very well. It also deals very, very, very deeply with its relationship to music, almost in a way that is plagiaristic, I believe. And it relates to music more in a way than it relates to movement. And the other thing it attempts to do is create the semblance of relationship, quote-unquote, relationships on stage between people, between groups. And I think that that happens naturally, but to impose that as a prerogative before you start a piece also I feel is a kind of a tacked on kind of thing. And I think that for me, as I've investigated action, and part of my job in being a choreographer, I think, is to look at the field and figure out what is the best thing that discipline can do. Like with words, it can tell a story. I agree with that. But with movement, I think the best thing movement can do is to be itself.
Well, you have some solo pieces.
Right.
When you're choreographing for yourself, and obviously knowing your body as well as you possibly can, what are you trying to then express with your body and the solo pieces that you do?
Well, I think that the one solo piece I'm doing right now is called Little Ease, and I do a dance in a box. A box that's about as big as the space I already occupy. And it's not, I don't believe that people watching, that I can control their response. I don't think even a literal narrative story can say for sure what the audience is going to get out of that story, literally speaking. But I think that what I'm trying to do is wake up people's movement memories, the muscle, all the historical physical experiences that lie within the cells of every person's body. If I can hit the right juxtaposition of time, space, and physicality, I feel like these are like poignant moments that exist almost as archetypes, movement archetypes. And if I'm accurate and articulate enough in the moves I'm doing and how I construct the order of those moves, I feel like an audience responds, a human responds, because they go, oh, I remember that. It's not literal. It's not like maybe it's a moment when they were five and they were walking down a grassy slope with leaves on it and they slipped and hit. You know, I don't know what exactly it would be, but it would get their attention because it would remind them of something that's familiar. And all of those things strung together end up being some sort of a recognition, a series of recognitions that's what I'm trying to elicit from the audience, a memory of physicality.
And you're talking about a body memory, a memory that's embedded in the body?
In the muscles. It's not something in your mind that you can, it's like, you know how smell operates?
Absolutely.
It's even less literal than smell, but it's there and it's really deep and it's really powerful.
You're 45 now.
I'm 45, yeah.
Do you have the same kind of strength, balance, even flexibility of a decade ago?
Well, gee, I don't know. I mean, part of the thing is I don't remember a decade ago. It's a good thing amnesia sets in after a certain point. But I still dance in the work. And although I am not in the trampoline dance and I don't do the more rigorous things, I feel that for a dancer my age, I should have a lot more chronic injuries than I do. I think my body's holding together really well. My mind that's going. No, I'm kidding.
Well, why do you think your body has held up so well? Good genes or literally this comes out of the kind of work that you've done?
I think it's a combination. I mean, I've had a very strong body. I've not had problems physically. Thank the Lord that I haven't. But I think that I started weightlifting. I mean, I've taken ballet for 20 years, but I started weightlifting about 10 years ago, and I think that it, right at the nick of time when probably my joints would have started to break down, I started to build up kind of the muscles around the joints and get my muscles to be more, as powerful at least as my bones. You know, I'm trying to, it's a huge race to osteoporosis. You know, if I get my muscles to turn into gristle before my bones start to shatter, then I can hold together, and I kind of think that's what's happening.
Well, Elizabeth Streb, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's choreographer-dancer Elizabeth Streb. Her troupe, Elizabeth Streb Ringside, is performing at the Joyce Theater in New York City for 3 weeks, beginning December 12th. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Kathy Wolf, and Joan Tui Westman. Research assistance from Rena Bander. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscoane.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Rhino Records, presenting Blues Fest, Modern Blues of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, a collection of contemporary blues artists including B.B. King, Robert Cray, and Stevie Ray Vaughan. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.